Hi, this is William Ramsey. Welcome to William Ramsey Investigates. On tonight's show, I have a very special guest. His name is Bill Taylor, and he's published two books, research books, fascinating books, original research. Highly recommended that people check these out. We're going to talk about these two books. One is titled Deep State Death by Braided Bathroom Belt, published 2021. And the other one is Deep State Fake Alien Invasion for Profit and Distraction. And they're a compilation or selected research and articles of, that he's published on D-State Analytics, which is www.d/state/research.com. Or actually, so anyway, he's going to talk more about that. Bill, are you there?
Yes, I am. I'm here.
Awesome. Well, thanks for agreeing to the interview. For people who may not have heard your background, can you talk about what piqued your interest in these, this kind of subject of the deep state, and what led you to write these two books?
Sure. Up until the 2016 election, 2017 aftermath, I was relatively not interested in conspiracy theories or deep state, or didn't even know that such a entity might exist. But I started to gain interest in probably the winter, spring of 2017, when the mainstream media became a reliable proponent of the sobriety and fairness of Robert Mueller. The mainstream media tends to stick with the script, but the script was so consistent that I thought it was worth my time to maybe see who this Robert Mueller was, because the MSM was pushing him so hard. And I had been following some other researchers, and we were loosely affiliated on Twitter. So a number of us started looking into Robert Mueller, and it turns out Mueller is a very interesting gentleman. He's not a bootstrap FBI type. He comes from a very wealthy and powerful family, not quite Rockefellers or Rothschilds or DuPonts, but certainly a supplier of materials to those families over the years, materials in the form of a lot of fertilizers and other commodities. But Mueller is a straight shooter. One of the rumors that came out, which was always interesting, was that his wife was related to the Cabells. His wife is named Ann Cabell Standish, and she is the internet would say that she was the granddaughter of General Charles P. Cabell, who was the CIA second in charge of the CIA during the Bay of Pigs and fired by JFK. That would also make her related to the Dallas mayor, Earl Cabell, who was president, or who was the mayor of Dallas in 1963 when President Kennedy was shot. Right. So doing just a little bit of ancestry work, I wanted to sort of see how related she was.
And yeah, but it's interesting. Sorry to interrupt, but yeah. Standish is like a Mayflower name. The first governor was Miles Standish, right?
Right, right. And it's that same family.
Right. So it's the Mayflower first colonial colonist. Sorry.
Right. No, and that's important because Cabell is really one of the first families of or Cable, as some people pronounce it. It might be pronounced Cable. I've heard it both ways. Cable is the first family of Virginia, one of those early colonists. But she is related to these two gentlemen, but pretty distantly. But what the internet really doesn't reveal is Bob Mueller's relationship. Are very interesting. He's actually the first cousin to Richard M. Bissell, one of the other three CIA executives who were canned by JFK after the Bay of Pigs.
Right. Helms, was it Helms? No, it was Cabell. Dulles,
Cabell, and Richard Bissell. Richard Bissell is really. He was director of plans for the CIA, so he comes up on a lot of lists of possible C-suite level people in government who might have been involved with the JFK assassination. He was involved in all sorts of intrigue for many years, including the U2 incidents. Just about name it. Bissell was really believed to be the brains behind the operation. These nefarious operations, but the interesting part, the part that got me on the track of George Lincoln Rockwell, which we'll talk about in a minute, was somebody had pointed out or it had been noticed that Bob Mueller had a summer house on Gibson Island, Maryland. Gibson Island's on the western shore of Maryland. It's about an hour south of Baltimore. It's probably the most exclusive address in the country and the most secure address. It really is an island attached to the mainland by a causeway, 500 yards long. It has security at the front gate. It's unless you're invited or unless you have a really good reason to be there, you're not getting on Gibson Island, even right, though it is incorporated.
Half of it is like land that's in a park or a golf course. So there's very few open spaces there to begin with, right?
Right, right.
And it's about an hour's drive from downtown D.C., hour and a half maybe?
Yeah, about an hour and a half. And it's pretty close to Annapolis as well.
Right.
And then just south of Baltimore. So Gibson Island, looking at Mueller – It's a small island with respect to the size of the population. As of now, as of 2021, there's probably about 150 houses. These are large summer cottages. These are not Jersey Shore rentals. But these houses have been in families since mostly the 1920s, and even in the post-war years, post-World War II years, 1940s to say 1970, the population, the number of households were probably 50 or even a little bit less than that.
Less. So these are summer homes. But name some of the names where Mueller is associating with or summering with.
Sure. So some of the names that most of us will know will be. Eugene DuPont had a house on Gibson Island. Henry Sturgis and Alexandra McCain Morgan is another power couple. Alexandra McCain is John McCain's sister. She recently passed. Another power couple, Godfrey Rockefeller and Margaret Kuhn Rockefeller. Godfrey Rockefeller he's about the second or third cousin away from the Nelson. Lawrence, the five brothers.
Right.
William Stuart Symington, he was a senator, first secretary of the Air Force, I believe, and he was President Kennedy's first pick to be vice president. Another one is Bob Woodward, used to live on the island. He lost his house in a divorce, I believe, in the 1980s. And then surrounding these names that you would know, that many people would know, names from the deep state. You have a lot of Alex Brown executives, which was headquartered in Baltimore, W.R. Grace Chemicals, DuPont executives. It's just a number of names that you would know who they work for, if not necessarily the last name. And these are all very powerful people.
Right. So, and for people who may not know what it's like, maybe on the East Coast or in that area of D.C., summering is a very social event. And it's a question that's asked in D.C. Where are you summering? What are you doing for the summer? So they're quasi holidays, but they're also networking. There's tons of networking that goes on. A lot of business type stuff.
Lots of business. And we have those. I'm in New Jersey. So we have some pretty high net worth zip codes in New Jersey. Rumson, New Jersey comes to mind, Spring Lake. But the access is very easy. There's no cutoff. They might all socialize together in some of the clubs, but there's no restrictions about driving around and looking at the
right. But what's houses. What's more interesting about Gibson is probably 1 in 1,000 people would know what the Gibson Island is. So it's actually it's not talked about. It's not
right.
Public.
It's so. Not talked about at all. I've Rumson, New Jersey, and Spring Lake, New Jersey are people in the other parts of the country know Rumson and Spring Lake. And then in the high, in the Hamptons in New York is, of course, the same idea, but everybody knows that. But I had never heard of Gibson Island until 2017. And I was very surprised how much wealth and power were concentrated on this little island since the 1920s.
Right. It is pretty incredible about all those people who are attached or connected to it. Other names that people might know, Mary Pinchot Meyer, who was in your book. She died in 1964 after Kennedy. She was Kennedy's lover, married to Meyer, who was the head. I think he was the head of and CIA trying to manipulate the media, right?
Right.
So it was
right.
Operation Mockingbird. So there's all these strange connections there.
Almost everybody has a connection to intelligence or one of the cutout companies, whether right. it's a legitimate company like DuPont actually making things, or if it's some maybe some sort of a consulting or investment bank.
And one of the interesting things you talk about too is how many of these people made money off war. So there were people who made cash during World War I, World War II, all these other wars.
I believe that the island was the island was, of course has always existed, but it was prior to the 1920s, it was more of a fishing village or a temporary a seasonal stop for clammers and crabbers along the Chesapeake Bay. But in 1920-21 is when the father of William Stewart Symington formed a stockholding company to develop the island. And he hired Olmsted, the designer of Central Park, to do the landscaping and the greenery. You know, it was a very wealthy and high, high-end project. So right. you start to see some of the Baltimore rich and powerful buy pieces of these properties. You see the Muellers, I believe, arrived in 1928. And, just going through the residence list, I have a couple of old directories and I have some newer lists. But, some of the names, once I had gone through the list of people that are recognizable, I started to look at some of the names that are not necessarily recognizable in any form. But since they are on that island, the metadata suggests that they probably have some. They probably acquired their wealth. They're probably very wealthy or powerful, and really have some reason to be there. They're just not going to let anybody buy
it. Right. Well, you talk about the Walkers were there. So George Herbert Walker Bush, that was the Walker family that his dad named him after. Right. So these guys also name each other after their close associates and things like that. So you'll see mixed names, Peter family, Bagley, who you're going to talk about. A lot of interesting characters.
Yeah. Yeah. So Charles Pierre Cabell, the Cabells are actually from Texas, the Charles and Earl, but they are related to the Pierres of Gibson Island. So there's another JFK connection back to Gibson Island. One of the earlier names that I came across that turned out to be very interesting, and this is where we get into the George Lincoln Rockwell part of the book. The book is divided essentially into three sections. There's a UFO as a false flag, essentially, extremist groups as false flags, and then I go into the Pelosi family from some recent files, and they all sort of interconnect. But Aerosmith, I had never heard of Aerosmith before. Trying to find, this is going back to maybe 2018, trying just to find out a little bit of information about him. The Google's not working. The search engines are not working. I finally put his name into the FBI vault, the FOIA, public access vault. And I started getting hits on Harold Noel Aerosmith. And as it turns out, Harold is from Gibson Island, as mentioned, which is what prompted the look to begin with. And Harold shows up in the FBI files starting about 1958. There was a synagogue bombing in Atlanta, Georgia, in 1958. It was done at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and it was nobody was hurt, but it was certainly devastating. It was national news. The Georgia Bureau of Investigations dedicated 70 agents to it. The FBI dedicated more. It was a real effort to go and find out who bombed this synagogue. During their within a couple of days, the FBI or the Georgia Bureau of Investigations picked up five redneck Klan sympathists from in a general area. They belonged to a group called the Knights of the White Camellia. they were sort of a ragtag group of undereducated violent felons, essentially. One of the people in the group was a gentleman named Wallace Allen, and when the FBI spoke with him a number of times, it was found in his possession a letter from George Lincoln Rockwell, who's really the subject of these chapters in the book.
And who is George? For people who don't know, I write about Rockwell in my new book, Global Death Cult, just because of his influence on some of these modern far-right groups. But yeah, I have a picture of him being shot in Northern Virginia. I actually lived by where he got shot when I was in D.C. So he was kind of a known figure, at least in that Northern Virginia area of, Virginia. It was, I can't even remember the name right now. Roslyn, Virginia was really where he was shot. So, sorry, please continue.
Okay, I was going to say, on the cover of the book, that's George Lincoln Rockwell with the pipe. Next to the map of Gibbs on Otto Skorzeny. So Rockwell is after the letter is found in the possession of Wallace Allen, the FBI goes to Newport News, Virginia, or the Norfolk area. They want to talk to Rockwell. The letter says that there was going to be a big bang. It looks like Rockwell might have known something about this synagogue explosion. And with him is Rockwell is relatively cooperative. I believe with him at the time was Harold Arrowsmith from Gibson Island. Wow. And that's when things get interesting from my point of view, in that Harold and Arrowsmith turns out to be quite a character. And it's led me to the idea. Now, other people have had this idea, but it's led me to the idea of that Rockwell, who founded the American Nazi Party in 1959, was a less than organic Nazi. His benefactor was this gentleman, Harold Arrowsmith. And Harold Arrowsmith was a bachelor, and he had a lot of money. He comes from a wealthy Baltimore family by way of New York. If you look at the Arrowsmith family tree, there's a lot of Greenwich Village street names in the family tree, which means they've been there a long time. There's a Lispinard, Bleecker, if you know Bleecker Street. These are old parts of New York City. So he's a very, very important family that never made much waves. Eastern establishment all the way since prior to the Revolutionary War, and he's essentially Rockwell's benefactor in Rockwell's effort to form this Nazi party and to sort of instigate violence and call attention to his Nazi cause. What Arrowsmith winds up doing, he provides Rockwell with about $2,300 worth of cash. I think it's about $23,000 today. A printing press. He buys Rockwell a house. Rockwell has, I think, four daughters actually, and he's basically the man behind Rockwell. And it makes one consider the idea that Arrowsmith had been maybe approached to do this at the Gibson Island Club, for that matter, or prompted, or maybe even blackmailed into really being the funds behind this Nazi movement. And if that's the case, then is the Nazi movement real at all, at least in the 1950s?
Well, don't you write that Rockwell really wasn't like an early begetter of Nazism? Like, he changed sometime in the 50s. Like, oh, I'm having a dream about Hitler. I'm a Nazi. Right.
Exactly. I think the dream came in 1955 when Hitler visited him in a dream.
So it's strange. It's not an organic. His whole transformation isn't organic into that far right thing where somebody reads these books and hangs out with somebody or is online today or something.
Right.
Like that.
Right. And you think about early or mid 1950s, you know, the World War II was pretty fresh in the mind of a lot of people, and it's a pretty extreme view. Even it's extreme today, but you know, 1955, people had brothers and fathers and sons freshly killed from World War II. Right. So, you know, it's a pretty aggressive move to take in backing the Nazis or the philosophy in any way, shape or form. But the thoughts and the ideas that Rockwell had, you know, which was financed by this gentleman, Harold Arrowsmith, it sort of leads into another, you know, it sort of led me just a little bit off the Rockwell path, and I started taking a closer look at Arrowsmith with the idea that his origins might give us an idea as to whether the Rockwell promotion of Nazi ideas was really there because he believed it being a Nazi, or there was it almost sounds silly to say an ulterior motive for being a Nazi. If that's possible, you know, because if you have an extremist group, just to step back a little bit, if these Rockefellers and these Rothschilds and DuPonts and Muellers and Symingtons really are playing sort of a dialectic game, and trying to shape the course of history from a New World Order perspective, then it sort of does make sense to have an extremist group, because you could use them for a lot of things.
Right.
You could have them blow up a synagogue. You can have them chase down the freedom buses. You know, just about anything, because at that point the people at the top of the pyramid are so far removed, and there's, you know, almost no connection could be
made. Well, on the opposite side, you want to talk about dialectical? You can talk about the Symbionese Liberation Army. Which, in my mind, was completely made up by the government, and was from the left. So they were subverting the left. They were getting people arrested, killing people. So that was a perfect example of the government, and probably a part of Operation Chaos, which brings up James Jesus Angleton, which you mentioned in the book. So there's definitely some element, true, authentic, factual research that backs up this backing of social movements. Sorry.
Right, and there's certainly precedent for you know, inorganic left-wing groups.
Right.
You need them to infiltrate the legitimate ones. If you think of the civil rights movement, you would certainly want to infiltrate the civil rights movement. You know,
right. Look at the FBI and the Black Panthers. I mean, there's all kinds of infiltration and subversion, and even Martin Luther King, who was, you know, not as radical as the Black Panthers. Sorry.
Right. So with the idea that really Arrowsmith is from the Eastern elite school of thought, or the school of New World Order thinking, and that includes a lot of things, including eugenics, war profiteering, just about any evil you can think of. You know, his family tree is certainly connected to that. His father was actually, Arrowsmith. Arrowsmith's father, Sr., Harold Sr., was a canon at the Baltimore Episcopal Cathedral. He had it was a very, very high status, noticeable type of position as the bishop of Baltimore for the Episcopal Church.
And you got to remember too, Baltimore at that time pre-war was very wealthy, or even post-war, it's kind of gone downhill. But they used to be one of the big economic hubs of the U.S.
Right, you had a lot of shipping into there, mm-hmm. But even the father had some left wing connections. He was father was investigated for consorting with the Russian War Relief Fund. This was a fund started in World War II to send humanitarian aid essentially to the Russians during the war, but it was soon infiltrated by communists, not set up by communists here, That institution, Russian War Relief Fund, was originally funded by Rockefeller and Carnegie Foundation. So you have this prominent bishop or canon from Baltimore involved with these. So he would be familiar, you know, there's another angle where he would be familiar with the dialectic, with the maybe the plans of the Rockefellers and the foundations at the time. There was there's certainly other evidence in the Sun Jr.'s resume, and we'll get to that. But you know, I think it's pretty. I think I established the idea or the fact that that the Aerosmith family was very high, and it would be unlikely for an organic creation of a Nazi movement from this group. I mean, they might have had Nazi sympathies or something, but there's certainly better ways of doing it. And what you really need is somebody like George Lincoln Rockwell, who presents well. He's a kind of a charismatic guy, and who could provide cover for any nastiness that goes on going forward, right, including getting shot.
But you can farm, you know, you can get these groups, and then you get the radicals, and you get the radicals to do something for you, and you can identify people. There's purposes behind the string pulling, right?
Well, there's, and I believe that they play, you know, these, we'll call them the deep state and the New World Order types. They play on different levels in that, or they try and kill one, you know, two birds with one stone. You can have the violence next day, you know, next week by blowing up a synagogue, but then they'll play the longer game of maybe pitting Jews against Christians or black people against whites, you know, to sort of instigate with initial violence, but then sow the seeds of distrust for decades. Right. You know, all under a plan, not necessarily just by accident. That's my broad thesis. But you know, just to get back to Rockwell, you know, the idea that he was being, that he was a pawn for the NWO or the deep state, the evidence has actually come out, you know, relatively recently that, you know, he was playing a part. He actually came from a family of actors, of vaudeville actors. So that's one check. He adapted one of the more, there's a good paper out there by, I believe, a University of Glasgow dissertation student or a doctoral student, in his dissertation that compares the Rockwell philosophy to some other gladio type philosophies that emerged in the 1950s. So Rockwell adopted this idea of a leaderless resistance, which if you're familiar with the gladio operations in Europe, it's the idea of stay behind cells. And since they would, these gladio cells would presumably be behind Soviet lines, and if there was ever invasion, they could operate without having a leader sort of overseeing the whole battlefield. This is an idea that Rockwell adapted for the United States on a presumption that maybe the New World Order would take over, or the Chinese or the Russians for that matter. It would have most likely been the Russians at that point in the 1950s and 60s. One of the primary proponents of this leaderless resistance organizational structure was a gentleman named Julius Amos. And I won't go too deep into him because we could write another book about Julius Amos. But Amos was involved in the Bay of Pigs training of some of the troops. He was a member of several YMCA national groups. YMCA had a reputation for sort of spy work for a long time. He was involved in a Project Blue Book incident, which is in the book. Most of all, Amos was a Gibson Island resident. He was a neighbor of Aerosmith and Godfrey Rockefeller and Eugene DuPont and Robert Mueller Sr. and the whole crew. You know,
cabal, you know, perhaps?
The cabal. You know, he was definitely, certainly not wealthy and powerful to the extent those gentlemen were, but he's like the worker bee.
Right. He's part of the network. It's a big network.
Part of the network. Yeah. You know, you can't all be chiefs.
Right.
So there you have Rockwell taking the work of this other Gibson Islander, being financed by another Gibson Islander, all under the watchful eye of Symington, the Morgans, the Muellers, and the DuPonts. So I would suggest, you know, that Rockwell, you know, Rockwell was really not much of a Nazi, but more of a person that was picked to play the Nazi. And he did it very well, and he played it up very well with the pipe smoking and the armbands. And I think he had a Hitler mustache at one point, you know. So someone that really the public could focus their hate and attention on, instead of maybe some other more nefarious actions that were, and I hate to say more nefarious than being a Nazi, but you know, more nefarious type of crimes that were going on in the 1950s, and that would include, you know, the communist movement, but even larger than that was the, you know, stealing of nuclear secrets or military secrets, right, from army bases.
Right, the NUMEC thing, you write about that in your other book.
NUMEC, the Fort Monmouth incident, which is another whole chapter. It gets very interesting in that these industrial and military secrets keep disappearing from these bases. And, you know, at the head of this cabal, the idea, if you read some of Aerosmith's rants, Aerosmith keeps pointing at a Jewish conspiracy. So if you're going to have a Jewish conspiracy, you need a Nazi front group to sort of, make any participants in the Jewish conspiracy, if one exists, sympathetic figures. You're trying to misdirect with a bombing so that if there actually is a conspiracy by some types, then the focus always falls back on the Nazis.
Back on the Nazis, right. And there was actually, I mean, I read a book, Ghost, that discusses James Jesus Angleton being kind of a Zionist in a way, but also supporting like they knew that this, you call it highly enriched uranium, was being taken from the Apollo plant outside of Pittsburgh, right? So some of these guys knew that this was happening. So I think that the cover, the front story for the public is it was stolen. But then it goes to the present, like you talked about, the importance of uranium and people making money off of that.
Right. And this is where probably I believe that this Nazi movement, George Lincoln Rockwell, false Nazi play, school play, and the Apollo affair where the uranium disappears. One of the rants that Aerosmith makes. So Aerosmith, I'll just step back a little bit. Aerosmith funds Rockwell. Rockwell decides he's going to start a newspaper, the Virginian. It's all anti-Jewish type hagiography and rants. Aerosmith starts making a nuisance of himself around Washington, D.C., barging into congressman's office, saying that there's a Jewish conspiracy. Everybody kicks him out. After a while, everybody essentially knows who this Aerosmith is. One of the incidents that Aerosmith did to really attract attention to himself was when he bought the printing press for Rockwell for his newspaper. He goes to Mr. Ziegler, who owned a printing press store, and starts mouthing off how he's going to be writing subversive material and he needs a printing press to do this and it's anti-Semitic. The guy's name is Ziegler. I mean, he's basically telling this person who was supposed to be part of this huge Jewish conspiracy what exactly he's going to do. Of course, Ziegler, they're also going to boycott or picket the Israeli embassy in a couple weeks. So Ziegler, the first thing he does is call the FBI, saying we have this nut person in here. He sounds like a named Harold Arrowsmith, and the FBI basically puts Arrowsmith on sort of a watch list and follow him about as he goes around spreading the idea that there's a Jewish conspiracy. I think one of the telltale incidents that he really sort of lets out that he's actually playing a part, just like Rockwell is he goes after a gentleman named Admiral Louis Strauss was more of a he acquired his admiral rank during World War II or shortly after. He had been a Kuhn Loeb partner for 30 or 40 years. And then when World War II came around, they gave him the rank of admiral. He was in charge of ordnance. But this admiral keeps, asks the FBI, for any updates on Arrowsmith. Arrowsmith is yelling out Bolsheviks. But I think what Arrowsmith is really doing here, he's seeding the idea that every Jew in every person of Jewish descent is somehow involved in this huge conspiracy, and therefore any accusations made about maybe a tiny conspiracy consisting of a few Jews is going to be anti-Semitic. He's able to make himself look so crazy that any suggestion is the calling card of a madman, if that makes sense. And interestingly, and this is where sort of this dovetails with the NUMEC incident, the missing uranium, which was discovered had disappeared in 1965, and we're still in the 1950s here, but 65 is when it was discovered to be missing. The head of the Atomic Energy Commission in charge of making sure uranium doesn't go missing was Admiral Strauss, of Kuhn Loeb, the Kuhn Loeb partner for 30 or 40 years. So if there is a conspiracy, it's certainly not a Jewish conspiracy, but it's a Kuhn Loeb conspiracy, and the Kuhn Loeb partners included Jacob Schiff. You have Warburg. You have Oppenheimer. You have Kuhn and Loeb themselves, and all as basically agents of the Rothschild banking system from prior to World War, prior to the Civil War.
Right, they finance. I mean, Schiff is right there, he's right there in Congress. He's the offspring of Schiff, right. And they finance. They actually took care of some of the communists, and which one was it? It was Trotsky, I think, lived with the Schiffs in 1905 or something like that before right. He got sent back to Russia and destroyed it.
Right. So what they're really trying to cover up here with or distract from is the involvement of this Kuhn and Loeb cabal in American politics, in wars, in finance, and in industry since prior to the Civil War. The Rothschild, by the 1880s, the Rothschild's name was a very difficult name to mention in Washington circles, under the idea that, they had under the idea that they really financed a good portion of the Confederate States and had been involved in trying to create a central bank for a long time. So they would use Kuhn Loeb as one of their primary agents, and there were certainly other Asian banks as well, but Kuhn Loeb is probably the most famous and more nefarious.
Yeah, it's really incredible. So then, you make the argument, whether do you think that Arrowsmith was playing a game or was he really a Nazi?
I believe he was playing a game, but he was classified as psychotic during World War II when he was drafted. And he was a very poor student. So there's a possibility that he was serious, but they played him as the sort of these overlords, these Rockefellers and Rothschilds, played him as the mad, goofy, psychotic anti-Semite. I tend to believe that he's probably was playing a part and he was well aware of what he was doing. Like I said, he was a lifelong bachelor. Maybe they had something on him,
right.
You know, to get him to go along. But I would argue that he knew what he was doing. Even if sort of his personnel files say that he was too psycho to
right. And you said he was corresponding with Hans Reckenberg. He was literally a true ex-Nazi, right?
Right. That's where things get, you know, even more interesting is that you do have, he had been to Germany a number of times and, sort of espousing the, Aryan, you know, the Aryan, race theories that were all, you know, thrown out during World War II of, you know, skull sizes, measuring skulls and right. You know, they come from the Asian steppes. But, he does go back to after him and Rockwell had a falling out in about 59-60 and, Aerosmith goes to Berlin, actually to Munich, and starts talking to some of these really legitimate ex-Nazis, if that's a word. You know,
no, there is, because there was a number of them around that were public.
Right. Right. So the CIA station in Munich, and this is all in the public files. CIA station in Munich, you know, keeps tabs on Aerosmith and notes that he's talking to Reckenberg. Reckenberg had worked for Göring and Bormann, and he was a free man in Germany, and he mostly played the part of sort of advocating for some of the German general war widows and families that, you know, were looking to get some of their money back after it was seized by the Allies, or property, or essentially trying to make the war widows and children comfortable, if not the outright Nazis if they were still alive. And that's where Aerosmith is corresponding with Reckenberg, and I believe it was January of 61. And the same week, Reckenberg is corresponding with Otto Skorzeny, who might be the most famous super Nazi of all times, as far as abilities and, you know, legend and bravery. You know, Otto Skorzeny, I believe he rescued Mussolini with a hang glider and,
right.
Attacked castles by himself. He was just a super Nazi, and
yeah, he was involved in the Battle of the Bulge. Then right. When the war was over, he was pretty much kind of like a mercenary for hire, guns running. And then he was literally a Mossad. He was hired by the Mossad. He betrayed a lot of ex-Nazis who were trying to build bombs in Egypt. He just didn't. I mean,
he was involved.
Tough guy to know.
Yeah, tough guy to know. But he shows up in a JFK literature. I mean, there's so much has been written about JFK assassination. You know, if you want to add another person to the list, excuse me, I'm sorry.
Skorzeny,
Skorzeny shows up pretty often.
And he really rose up through the ranks just through his true meritocracy. He grew up and kind of. There's pictures of Skorzeny with Hitler.
Yeah. He's definitely probably, I think he would be high on my list now, and he's high on my list because of this potential relationship with Aerosmith. I won't say that he had a relationship or they ever met, but it is interesting that the same week that Aerosmith was writing letters to Reckenberg, Reckenberg was writing letters to Skorzeny, and, you know, if there's something in the files, I haven't found it yet, but that would be the connection to between sort of these elite deep staters, the Rockefellers and the Muellers and the DuPonts on Gibson Island, to, you know, the Nazi the Nazi mercenary forces, which were still active and probably very capable.
Yeah, and so eugenics kind of bonded them together. They're very similar interests. You can see that eugenics. I mean, it's interesting. I didn't know that Pinchot Meyer's dad was a heavy eugenics type. Yeah. So you see that strain run through the Eastern elite, no doubt.
Yeah, no, very definitely. And Gifford Pinchot, her uncle, is another interesting story, but not for today. So he shows up. Aerosmith sort of disappears off the map. He's still making a name for himself. He's suing the Pulitzer, he's suing, excuse me, not Pulitzer, suing the Hearst Corporation. There was even a lawsuit relatively recently where his heirs were sued somebody because they were accused of being anti-Semites because they were related to him. But then Rockwell sort of goes off on his own, and he's playing the part of the antagonist, and of course he's assassinated in 1967. But I think it comes across, and I think I make the point that really it's sort of this dialectic playing out at a very high level, and then at a low level it's operational, it's tactical, bombing synagogues and just one other sort of maybe dovetail with the NUMEC and the Apollo affair and the disappearance of the uranium. NUMEC was controlled by Shapiro and it's believed the Mossad stole it, but really, very likely they, it was just sold. But if you have a group like Rockwell and his American neo-Nazis, it might be very advantageous to have these thugs go in and maybe blow up a Pittsburgh synagogue with them all in it this time, if they ever needed to be made quiet. Shapiro was never arrested or criminally charged with any of these with any of the missing uranium, but you could say
missing in quotes and unquotes, right? Because right, we just had right. the Uranium One scandal. Right. So it wouldn't be that wasn't the first or only time that uranium is
traded. I would say it's probably been going on almost every incident. I mean, in the UFO section of the book, I list a couple of other incidents with the idea that these UFO incidents near nuclear bases or nuclear power plants. I'll mention one in particular. The Apollo incident occurred in 1965, or it was discovered in 1965. It's probably been going out the back door for at least 4 or 5 years, and that overlaps with the Kennedy administration. There's a famous UFO incident that occurs in if it goes missing in, say, May or June, or discovered missing in May or June by the regulators, Atomic Energy Commission. In September, October, the Kecksburg UFO incident occurs, and that's only 30 miles away. And what you have there is the Army personnel and Air Force personnel and Project Blue Book officers coming in and sealing off the entire area where the supposed UFO crashed. Wow. And I would argue that it was probably a cleanup operation after the AEC and the FBI started asking questions.
Bring in the Blue Book stuff to cover everything up?
Yep. And I believe it happened at Fort Monmouth in 1951 when the Rosenbergs were arrested. I believe it probably even Roswell in New Mexico in 1947 probably happened there. And the most interesting part is Project Blue Book was started in 1952. It was a new program started by William Stuart Symington of Gibson Island. Wow. He appointed General Charles P. Cabell to be the commander of Project Blue Book. And one of the first reports of a UFO reported to Project Blue Book in April. Okay, Blue Book started in February. In April, Ulysses Amos submits a report to Cabell that UFOs were over Gibson Island. And Sally Symington is very upset about it. And
wow, that's incredible. So it just all goes back to Gibson. And just yeah. to go, just to bring it all full circle, Mueller was sabotaging Trump the entire time. Do you know that he destroyed, like illegally destroyed evidence of all these texts that was probably, 100,000 texts that will never be public again? And he was the head of the FBI. Like yep. He's managed prosecutions where you cannot destroy any evidence. And it's just an incredible event. He just covered up all of this stuff that he does. I mean, he was, and that 2-year investigation was all trash, and they probably knew it from the beginning.
Right. I'll we could wrap it up right there. I'll you reminded me of another Mueller.
Please go ahead.
Mueller factoid, because this is so I'll just be brief, but I try and make all this historical and Cold War history and intrigue relevant to current events. So that's where Mueller comes in. If you go back and look at Mueller's father, Mueller worked for DuPont for a long time. We believe, and the files are very difficult to come by, but we believe some of my helpers believe that the father worked on the Corona project, a satellite project, which was basically a camera sent to space, powered by plutonium. So you have a radioactive source there, this is all very valuable stuff. After retiring from DuPont, Robert Mueller's father starts the firm of Tugwell and Mueller. His partner Tugwell was the head of Engelhard Industries and was the boss of Mark Rich, the famous absconder of all sorts of materials and illegal trading with Iran. I would suggest that probably Mark Rich got his start by brokering uranium between the U.S. and between Apollo and in Israel.
Interesting. That makes perfect sense. And then he got a pardon, right? Got a pardon by Clinton. Do you have time to take a few questions? People are curious.
Sure.
There's one. Do you expect a fake alien invasion?
I think the more that it gets out, the less likely it becomes. The more people that say, and you see this a lot on Reddit or Twitter, I believe that's it was in the plans. It's there. The book is written. The play is everybody's in the positions. I believe that they intend to roll it out, but there's just too many people talking about it now. And there's no interest in the current alien. Nobody believes it right now, anyway.
Right. But if you look at the Stars Academy, there's all kinds of occultists and intel people involved in that too.
It's almost like the transparency prevents it from happening.
Right. That's a good point. Here's another question. Today, with all the extremist distractions, what are the elites trying to cover up?
I believe that they're trying to cover up the essentially 100 years of the CFR. The CFR, if anybody doesn't know, will turn 100 years old on July 29th of this year. And I believe that they are behind some very, very nefarious type of activities. The predecessors started World War I. They probably let World War II go on a lot longer than it had to go on. All with the idea of obtaining power and subverting sovereign governments.
I mean, wasn't the CFR really just a Rockefeller front, or was it more than that?
I believe it was a Rothschild and Rockefeller front. And gotcha. Actually, there was a company called the, it's on a website, and I have the clipping for it, Belgian American Coke Company. And the Belgian American Coca is a very small blurb, I believe it's from the Wall Street Journal of 1921. So it was published in the same day that the CFR was formed, maybe a day after. You have all these Rockefeller interests, including George Herbert Walker. You have Thomas Fortune Ryan, who started the American Tobacco Trust. All these big shots in the American side. Then you have all these agents from Belgium on the other side they were essentially working for the Rothschilds through Credit Society. So they formed this company. It looks like the capitalization for the CFR came from basically the Belgians as representatives of the Rothschilds, and then the Rockefellers represented by Thomas Fortune, Ryan, and George Herbert Walker, and maybe some others.
Wow, that's amazing. And then the Bushes really are kind of fronts for the Rockefeller interest as well.
Oh,
Chase Bank, all that stuff. Really fascinating insight into kind of people see the strings, people pulling the strings are all there on Gibson Island. Really right. Incredible research. So thanks so much for reaching out and conducting this interview. Where can people buy the books?
They can go to my website. It's, the website is called dstateanalytics.com. If you put it in any other search engine except for Google, it'll take you right there. So DuckDuckGo, Yahoo, and Bing, whatever. Just don't use Google. Dstate Analytics.
It's a dash, work. Right? D-dash.
And then the URL is d-state-research.com.
Gotcha. d-date-research.com. And is there, if people want to contact you, can they send you an email through that?
Yeah. Yeah. There's my email's on there. Awesome. And the links to the books can be reached through the website or they're on lulu.com. I think that's a little Taylor.
Excellent interview. Thank you so much for your time. Again, the title of the book is Deep State Fake Alien Invasion for Profit and Distraction. Selected articles from D-State Analytics 2 by Bill Taylor. Bill, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Are you still there?